the season finale of the Cigar Thoughts podcast. I'm your host, Jackson Bevins with FieldGoals.com. With me today is Danny Kelly, my editor at Field Goals. Matt Nichols, former all-conference offensive lineman at Pacific Lutheran University, helped him win national championship there. Appreciate you being
always
here.
Always, Jackson, always.
And my original co-host, the editor-in-chief of What's Up Magazine, Brent Cole. And,
Hi, Brent.
Hey!
We're here. Well, we were going to be here even if the Seahawks won, but we're here because the Seahawks lost. And it's interesting because I feel kind of bad saying this, but to me there's almost like a sense of relief.
It's not just almost me.
That this season is over. And obviously I would have loved for it to have gone for another 3 weeks and been back to the Super Bowl. But I think all things considered, it was a pretty good run that they had this year with all of the distractions, with all of the psychological challenges they faced and the injuries. I thought they showed a really good account of themselves. They didn't do that in the first half, though.
No.
That was like just a goofy score. I remember at one point, it was 31-0 in late second quarter, and I remember looking at my buddy and saying, could you imagine if you just turned on the TV right now? Like, oh my gosh, the game started. Well, I wonder what the score is. It's 31. Like, it wasn't even in the database that was a potential way that game could go. And then, of course, you know, the Seahawks had a very spirited comeback. And much in the way like we were talking before the game, how Jermaine Kearse's Super Bowl catch is this great effort that is sort of forgotten because of how the game ended, outscoring the number one team in the NFL record-wise, 24-0 on the road in the second half is an amazing feat. Sure. Just it wasn't enough, right? Mm-hmm. So just the latest in a long string of really goofy Seahawks playoff games. Danny, what was your kind of main reaction once that was over?
Well, first of all, when you go down 31-0, I mean, I think, first of all, obviously that is the worst deficit the Seahawks have had in the Pete Carroll era, mm-hmm. by probably a good amount.
At least 10, yeah.
And it kind of was, it kind of made me think, well, this is what it's like to be a fan of another team. Like, because pretty much every team gets blown out once or twice,
eventually,
a couple times a year.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, Seahawks haven't been blown out in 3 years. And I even tweeted it at the time. I was like, Seahawks haven't gotten their asses kicked in 3 years, 3+ years. Like, maybe this is finally it. And then, of course, they came back to within 7, almost, if they would have gotten the onside kick, could have been a whole different thing. So that was good to see them fight back in the second half and end the season on a high note in that sense that, you know, they didn't just get their asses kicked. They came back and made it a game, made the Panthers fans, you know, clench their butts a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I think it was just a weird first half. I remember thinking, okay, it's 14-0. If they score a touchdown here, it's going to be tough. Now it's 21-0. Okay, if they score a touchdown here, it's going to be really tough. They kick a field goal, it's 24. Okay, God, if they score a touchdown here, it's fucking over. Like, there's no way. And, of course, they came back and almost made it a game. So, I don't know. In terms of losing, it wasn't the most painful way to lose because I think it was cool that they made that comeback. It's not as devastating as the Super Bowl loss, obviously, just because it was a lot different feel to it. But yeah, I don't know. The first half, like Pete Carroll said, it was just chaos. It just got out of control. And the Panthers stepped on their throats. And credit to the Panthers because they didn't have any issues with the turf. They did what they were supposed to do. You know, they scored in the red zone. They made touchdowns, not field goals for the most part.
Took advantage of mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was the biggest thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Russell Wilson had a terrible first half, and that was enough to put them in a big hole. And, the offensive line really just sucked in the first half. Defensive line was getting gashed. All in all, it was just a terrible performance in the first half. Yeah. It was just one of those things.
It's football, though.
Yeah. You know, it started off with that big, long run.
First play.
So Earl typically hits him in the hole, and if Earl hits him in the hole, somebody else is going to rally to it, and it's a 6-7-8 yard gain, and you keep playing. And Pete Carroll said this after the game, this game was a microcosm of their season, where it started off so horribly and so much chaos. From the Cam holdout to the hangover from the Super Bowl to Bennett wanting a new contract. And then you get into this game where you have that long run, the touchdown, the interception for touchdown. It was just chaos the whole time.
Yeah.
And then finally, once they relaxed and got into a rhythm, you could see this team that we all fell in love with and why we love this team, because there's a freaking fighter's chance in them at any time. I mean, it got to 24-0 at that point. I was like, this has to hold, because that's still a 3-score game.
Yeah.
Realistically, it's a 4-score game. But they have to hold that. As soon as it goes to 31-0, that is a monumental task to come back.
Well, the biggest comeback, I think, in all of NFL history is 32.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, when you say it's a monumental, it's like...
Yeah.
Statistically and, proven, that's only they've only it's only happened once.
Yeah, and how long had Seattle been with having a lead in every single game? In two of the last four games that they've played, they haven't held a lead in.
Yeah.
We had gone four seasons with them holding
74 games.
Yeah, so we had gone that long of time, and now we have the St. Louis game and this. So it was just frustrating as all get out, and it was simple things. It was missed blocks that led to Russell being forced to throw. It was Earl slipping, whether it's because of cleats or bad angle or whatever. But all of these little things that just snowballed into a big thing.
And fumbles then, not recovered.
But yeah.
How different is the game if they get that first fumble?
Yeah. Exactly. Totally changes. And then in the second half, it seemed like they calmed down. They got back into a quicker paced offense because they had to.
Yeah.
And they came storming back. And quite honestly, they had a legitimate shot. What is it? 24% of all onside kicks in the playoffs are recovered by the kicking team. That's a really good... If you had a 25% chance to recover that, if they recover that ball...
Huska
hit it beautifully.
Yeah. And then Coleman hit... what's his name? That linebacker.
Yeah,
Thomas Davis.
And that almost made him... You know, he landed on his, like...
Face.
Shoulders.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. They recover that onside. That game is monumental because momentum has switched so bad.
Yeah.
But they didn't. It was a frustrating season and an exciting and... You know, somewhat rewarding one too. I thought, without it being a Super Bowl victory,
we got to see the beginnings of what the next phase of the next era of the Seahawks will be. And I think when you talk about it, you know, kind of being rewarding, that was you started to see the excitement in the second half of the season of what can happen, which will be different.
Kind of a transitional.
Yeah, thing. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and you also saw what an incredible job Pete Carroll does with his guys and with his program, because this could have imploded from the get-go, and they could have missed the playoffs very easily. Yeah. This could have been a 7-9 team, even with all of this incredible talent, just because of simple infighting and implosion. And he kept that team together probably better than any other coach.
He got them to peak.
He got them to peak at the right time and to play damn good football, which is a testament to Pete and what a good coach he is, but a psychologist and relating to players.
Right.
That can't go unnoticed. This has been a phenomenal job by Pete this year.
The first presser that Pete Carroll gave after the next day of the Super Bowl, it was outside the hotel, the team hotel in Arizona. And I remember, I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember at the time thinking that's exactly what he needed to say. Yeah. And he, you know, it took a while because the players were all hurt. You know, there was like the whole like blaming him for making that call. You know, the idea that he wanted Russell Wilson to be the hero of all this bull crap that they had to get through. You know, and they did it. They eventually made it through. And I think it like you said, it's just a testament to Carroll basically being the mastermind of the team psychology, this team psyche.
Yeah.
You know?
And most often, the loser in the Super Bowl
doesn't even make the playoffs.
Yeah, doesn't make the playoffs. If they do, they're out before they make it back to the Super Bowl. So, I mean, the Seahawks kind of fit in line with that. But then within that process, you could see that the team and the organization grew more than it's not a team on the decline.
Yeah.
It's a team that at least has a feeling like it's maintaining or will be bouncing back even harder depending on how things shake.
I think I feel more optimistic about next season than I did last year, even though they're bringing back almost all their guys. Mm-hmm. I feel more optimistic about next year, I feel like.
I do too, and then I remember 26 free agents, 19 of them.
Yeah, but to me it's all about Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, like, the Russell Wilson, the jump that he made this year was, it's monumental, it's huge, it's like,
everything starts there. And now Pete Carroll is like, okay, now he's ready to learn football.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
he jumped to being incredible. The most efficient quarterback in the NFL and having the most efficient end of season run that the NFL's ever seen, and Pete Carroll's like, good, now he's ready to learn.
Yeah.
Like, that's
Earl's
that's a really crazy thing. And so I think that you know, one thing that's really fascinating with this is, okay, they couldn't always be what they were. The 2012-2013 Seahawks, this best defense by a mile, like changing the game on how defense is played, building a defense from back to front. Marshawn Lynch having to shoulder so much of the burden, right? Like, those are unsustainable. They got 2.5-3 seasons of that model out of it. But they had to adapt in the same way that the Patriots and Steelers adapted from being run first, play defense, shorten the game type of teams to we will outscore you if we have to types of teams, is that, you know, we saw this year the Seahawks struggled in pass coverage early in the season. Marshawn never got going. And yet, they peaked doing something they've never done before.
Yeah.
With players that had never been a part of the Seahawks before. That kind of adaptability shows, okay, this isn't, hey, do you remember when our team was this? But this is a chance for the Seahawks to be really good in a number of different ways.
Well, you know, it's funny you'd mentioned the Pats and the Steelers, because I was listening to Kevin Harlan on KJR yesterday, and he said that those two organizations are a perfect example of what the Seahawks can be looking at because they've got the quarterback that is going to be the, you know, Russ will be here a decade from now. Russ will be in the quarterback. And those are two perfect examples of having, as long as you've got that holy shit quarterback running through the thread of everything, absolutely anything is possible. And you look at organizations like Denver, who have cycled through different quarterbacks and whatnot, who weren't able to maintain that consistency. But the Steelers, though, obviously they didn't get further on. And then the Pats, you know, those are two organizations that are phenomenal because of that quarterback. Well, and I've made my point. I'm done for the day. I'll see you guys later.
No, and one of the things that having the quarterback does is it allows your offense to be whatever it needs to be within the constraints of a salary cap.
Right.
Because they still put their resources into the defense. Even though Russell's going to, starting with this next year, is going to have a large cap hit.
But his salary jump is negated by the Marshawn drop, presumably.
Well, and Marshawn and Jimmy are still fairly even with what they have. It's going to be interesting to see how resources get shifted now on their offense. So are we going to be putting more, obviously with Marshawn gone, and we're assuming Marshawn's gone. I think at this point that's a safe assumption. With Marshawn gone, is some of those resources going to our offensive line, or is it going to go to being with our other receivers because we have that running back that we all think we have in Thomas Rawls,
who makes $500,000.
Yeah, who was like Russell Wilson the first 3 years of his contract, where it was a steal.
Yeah.
So how within this organization do resources shift going forward?
We're saving $6.5 million of Marshawn, which is killer, but it's not $11.5 million, which would be super killer. And the Percy money goes off, too, because I believe that was on the books, too. So,
yeah.
There was a Joel Corey article that came out yesterday that dove really deep into it. He is predicting the Seahawks will have about $16.5 million in cap room going into the offseason once the new cap numbers are announced.
But is that $16.5 million in cap room with us having 26 guys that are leaving?
I think that was him making some projections on some signings and stuff. But in terms of guys who are actually under contract, if everyone who's under contract is there next year, they still have 16.5 with the increase and all that. So, I mean, which is to say that they have a lot of flexibility, you know. They've done such a masterful job of signing a literal half a dozen all-pro players over the last 2-3 years, which is just crazy.
And like, signing them early.
How many teams in the free agent period have ever had this many all-pros at any time, much less for a 3-4 year stretch? It may have never been done in the history of free agency, and yet to still have the flexibility. And in order to do that, you need to have guys like a Thomas Rawls, or how Russell Wilson was, Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, Doug Baldwin, guys who are performing well beyond their pay grade. And we kind of went a couple years without that. And between Lockett and Rawls and guys like Cassius Marsh and Frank Clark, who came on, Jordan Hill, guys who aren't making a ton of money, Jeremy Lane, that's where you can steal the money to really pay the good guys and make sure you keep your all-pros. It's an impressive model.
Yeah. And we also know that Pete and John are always the self-scouters and critique of themselves, and maybe this year's offensive line didn't go as exactly as planned. So how are they going to tweak that? Because they don't bury their heads.
That was really prominent in this press conference and the things that were initially said right after the
and
game.
It's not a bury their head in the sands mentality. No. We know better. It's learning from your own mistakes and admitting it and then going forward and making changes. So there's going to be some substantial changes on this team while the core is still intact.
You know, though, but you talk about what you want to say. When we go to the offensive line, and obviously we're going to delve into this at some point today, I mean, you wonder, what's his name? Carroll brought up Christian's Holy and Glowinski. So you're back to young kids, some out of position, replacing other young kids who are somewhat out of position. Yeah. I'm wondering at what point are they going to actually have an anchor in there that will be able to solidify as these movie pieces come through, you know? I can't imagine for the life of me Sicoli actually starting at center and being ready to go, but at the same time it might end up, you know, being there. He kept him on the roster for that. So at some point, they're going to have an anchor. And if Okung makes $8 million somewhere else, then they're not going to pay him that kind of money. No. So I'm really curious how... I mean, he addressed the need to do something with the offensive line. Mm-hmm. But how he's going to do that in the framework of how they've done it, I can't see how it's going to be done.
Yeah, and I mean, if they do it through the draft, is it any better than just promoting the guys that have been on the roster and know how they're doing? That's going to be a very interesting position group to watch how that forms. And quite honestly, it might be one of those that towards the end of training camp when guys are getting cut, that some of those veterans are getting cut, they're still making additions.
But they
at
haven't
that point.
Done that in the past, at least with the offensive line.
At least with the offensive line. No, but this might be the time where they're looking for the ultimate values.
Hugh Millen was saying on KJR on Monday that he thinks it could be a 5-for-5, that every one of those guys is not starting, or at least not starting in the position
spot
they were. Yeah.
Well, Gilliam will probably still be there, but he might go to the left.
Right.
So. Mm-hmm.
And then is Britt going to go back out?
Hopefully not.
I wonder how many times you can do that.
Yeah. Right. On this position group that is known that you're supposed to not do that.
Right.
That you're supposed to have the you know, obviously, I don't know. Matt's right there, and he could tell us about it. But
it makes
that you're supposed to actually be together, working as a unit year to year to year.
Well, and one of the things that we noticed is during the regular season, they typically carry eight offensive linemen in a game. But in the playoffs, they carried 7. Glowinski was inactive for those games. So they were going with Lemuel and... to back up, and so it really puts you in and Alvin Bailey, and that really hamstrings you. You have to be able to play multiple positions. I don't think they want that as far as starters go, but guys have to be able to
Game day
active roster is an absolute nightmare in the NFL. It's ridiculous. If you have 53 guys on your roster, have all 53
you're just hurting
active.
The product. That's
it
what is. You're doing.
That's exactly
you're
what
hurting
it is.
The product.
It hurts every team out there. What is it? Carrying 4 receivers into a game and you lose a receiver.
Look at the Packers. The Packers exactly. That's one of the great football games I've ever watched. But a team playing for their season shouldn't be in a position where they're saying, okay, I guess we have to convert this guy mid-game to fill these roles.
Yeah.
Right? No one wants to see that. No one's like, yes, that's how football should be played. Mm-hmm. You know? So
you're still paying the guys. They're still getting paychecks. So have them active. It was done for competitive reasons, but it's a joke of a rule. Hopefully it gets changed.
One thing that really stood out to me about this past season that kind of perturbed me a lot was the slow starts. And Dan, I know that you mentioned it earlier, and Matt, you touched on it as well, is that, you know, this team not only started the season slow, but they started a lot of games slow. And, you know, for all the credit that we give Pete Carroll for being a master manipulator, a champion of philosophy and all that, and I think that he is. I really do. A big part of getting a team ready to play is how they come out and play from the get-go. And I started thinking about the last Seahawks playoff games, right? And you look at this one, 31-0 in the first half. You look at the Vikings game, they didn't score until the fourth quarter. You look at the Super Bowl, right? Down 14-0, Russell Wilson doesn't complete a pass until the 25th minute. The Packers game before it, right?
Yeah, I don't even know. They don't, what was that, 21-0?
It was, I think it was, what did it end up as? I don't remember, but it was three scores.
Started out really terrible.
Yeah.
Really terrible.
And so these are the biggest games, and for all of Pete Carroll's incredible success winning playoff games and pulling off these comebacks and never say die, you know, we've heard ever since he came here, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And I believe
it's
that.
It's a great mantra.
But sometimes it is how you start. And when you start down 31-0 or down 9-0 or down 14-0 or down 19-3, as we've seen in the last four playoff games, then, you know, that's just asking a lot out of your players. So, am I reading into this? Is this just coincidental that they've had some slow starts, not only to their seasons, but to their games? Or is there something systemic here that can be improved on?
That is a good question.
So, being down 9-0 in Minnesota, because of the weather, it's a 9-0 game. If a team's down 14-0 and from playing, I never worried if we were down 14-0. That's an easy comeback. 17-0, all right, I'm starting to think because now we're at three scores. 21-0 is when you're like, all right, we got to get our shit together and we got to get it together now because it's go time. 31-0 is a whole different ball game.
Were you ever down 31-0?
I don't ever remember. Possibly, yeah. Right. In college, maybe, but I don't remember at all. But it's one of those things. I think people worry about like 14-0s, but quite honestly, when you're playing a game and it's in the first or second quarter and it's 14-0, that's easy to wipe off. I mean, that literally is two plays, and the mentality is we're two plays away, like down two runs in a baseball game. It's a bloop and a blast and tie game. Football's the same mentality. We need to break a play and we need to pick a ball off, and we're back to even. One of the things that concerns me about the slow starts, though, is the slow starts are because they are beating themselves and not just getting outplayed. It's the missed blocks that force Russell to throw a quick pass that gets picked off and Kuechly runs it back for a touchdown. It's the interceptions versus Green Bay in the NFC Championship game that hurt us because they were bouncing off of Jermaine's chest plate. Those kind of things that are us beating ourselves are what's concerning to me. The score itself, not at 14, not at 21, really.
Well, it seems like, it, at least from what I've seen, it almost comes from an arrogance. Like, they don't get sharp early on. Like, the Heat. What was the Heat a couple years ago?
In San Diego.
Yeah, it was just... Yeah, the Miami Heat would just kind of half-ass it. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they go, oh, okay, well, it's the fourth quarter. We're down by 15. We got to kill it.
The thing about that, Pete Carroll was talking about this. He thinks they're over-trying.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I don't know the answer of why they're doing that. That's why I'm like, this
why
is...
Why do I have you here? Why are you here?
Yeah, what the hell, dude? Just because you live around the block.
No, but like Pete Carroll ascribed it to them over-trying. And he's always been about like every play is the same, every moment is the same, like Michael Gervais. Like, that is, there's no moment that's bigger than the next, right? And he thinks that part of it could be that people are trying too hard once they kind of get into their zone and, like, realize we just need to be
God,
us.
God, there's
so
could
I don't
be
know.
Some validity to it.
But why would that happen to Seattle more than any other team?
Because like, that's so talented.
Well, has it really, though? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, is has it?
Is it a coincidence that they've been down a couple games? I mean, it's like a four-game sample size, right?
Yeah, but I would say, I mean, I don't know. I'm projecting here, but...
Locking them.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe it's just coincidental. Four games is a really small sample size.
Yeah, I don't know.
But... when you think about an NFL player's career, how many playoff games do you get, right? So
Fred that, Jackson's first game.
Right. Yeah. How long has he been in the league? So when you're talking about a four-game sample size, sure, in a season,
in an NFL, that might
career, or whatever, but in a playoff career, four games is significant.
Yeah.
And, you know, to come out flat in the first half for four straight games. I'm not saying that there is a problem, but this is something that has kind of like lurked beneath the surface for me all year.
But it's also hunter versus hunted, and now that they are the hunted, I think they are getting, regardless, they are still considered one of the alphas of the NFL. So they are getting everybody's best shot at from the get-go. I was thinking back to when they played in Atlanta and lost in 2012. They were down 21-0 there.
And the game before that, they were down 14-0.
And again, the 14-0, that's a nothing. That is literally a nothing.
Yeah.
The 21-0, you could see where it was like they're so close, but they're beating themselves. They're dropping passes. They're missing blocks. They're missing tackles.
They're overthinking everything.
They're extending plays. I mean, there's a couple of times where Tony Gonzalez caught balls and should have been tackled 2 yards short and was able to get past. So they were beating themselves. And this team, through their losses, they beat themselves more than the opponents beat them.
But that's the Patriots, what we've said in the last 2 years.
Yeah, the Patriots beat them in the Super Bowl.
The only team that can beat the Seahawks is the Seahawks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's concerning and something to think about, but I would rather have a team that finishes strong.
I want to sorry to interrupt you, Jackson, if you're going to change the subject, but the point where you're like in a game, because I think, and I don't try and play the if you've never played, you don't understand the card very often. But, like, I think it is true. Like, in football, especially, it's chaos, right?
Yeah.
It's fucking chaos.
It's nuts.
It really is, because there's, you know, on the NFL, on an NFL team, there's 53 players, or 46 on a game, maybe 47 on a game. There's 20 coaches. There's, you know, position groups and personnel groups and everything. It's just total and utter chaos, right? But, like, being in a game, like you said, like, 14-0 is, like, nothing. Like,
no, it honestly is nothing. It's just, like, 14-0 is, like, 7-0. Like, honestly, there's no difference.
Yeah. But, like, fans are freaking out about it.
Yeah, right? Yeah, because they have a small sample size of what it is. And I think when you play and you get into a rhythm of it, you view it as a 60-minute or a four-quarter game. Whereas if you're 8 minutes in and you're down 14-0, you're honestly, you haven't made halftime adjustments. You've probably been on the field. If you're in the first quarter, you might have been on the field for two, maybe three series. So you have not gathered enough data to figure out exactly how the team is playing you. Mm-hmm. And if a team has made some major adjustments, like if they're dropping a DN back in coverage and running an outside backer blitz into a zone, it's really easy for a quarterback to throw into that coverage and get picked off for a pick six if they haven't seen it. So there's all of these things where you're trying to gather information. And if you just haven't gathered it enough, then you're in a real disadvantage. But you start to figure out what teams do. And they can only do so many things. I mean, the reality is a team can only run so many different combinations of offensive plays or so many different combinations of defensive plays. And once you figure out what they're doing and how they're doing it, how they want to attack you on a first and 10 versus a third and short, you get into a rhythm and you start to be able to pick it apart. So
yeah, I just think it's a fascinating thing in terms of, like, being in the actual game and, like how much do the players stress about that? Like, you're down 14?
No. So the year Isaac and I won the national championship at PLU, we were down 17 points in the first round of the playoffs with, I think there was, like, 7 minutes to go in the game. And there was never a doubt that we'd come back and win. We scored 21 points to end the game, and it led us through the playoffs. But there was never a doubt, because it was like, we are so close. All we need is that one break, that one shot, where you just feel like you're there. You feel like you're there. And it's also that competitive spirit. Like, if I'm going to be out there, I'm going to throw my best punches, and I'm going to give it everything I got. And that guy across from me might be better than me, or that defense might be better than me, but I'm not going to believe it until after the game. Like, I'm going to, whatever I have to do to psych myself up or to give myself false hope, I will give myself false hope all game long. And then at the end, if they beat me on the scoreboard, go shake a hand, slap a guy in the butt, and walk off the field. But you always believe that you're going to do it.
So Pete Carroll was kind of talking about that in, I think it was on 710, his interview. He was saying, you know, we've been there 14, you know, 10, 14 points. That's nothing. Like, I don't even really think about that. But then once it got to 31, we, we're giving our, we're putting ourselves in a really like.
But he also believed that he could come back,
and all of them talked.
And
all
that's
of them,
so yeah. crazy. And I know that's awesome.
But I think that's part of the problem, or could be. I mean, I'm not going to play couch psychologist with this, but it could be part of the problem is that they know they are so good that they come back.
Right.
That it's
right.
either a mix that they could either be trying too hard, or they're having a lapse in concentration because they know that at halftime they'll make the adjustments, they'll come back, they'll be such a good second half team, they'll blow the mm-hmm. team away. Then that, if you're looking at longevity, the long term with the franchise, you wonder if losing the Super Bowl and then losing on Sunday is actually beneficial in the long run. And maybe I'm just convincing myself of this. I don't know. Is that? But it gives you.
Yeah.
They can no longer say, "Well, shit, we'll just come right back," and Blair Walsh will miss a field goal or something.
Yeah.
They can no longer rely on saying, "Well, we're the team of destiny," because they weren't. And you wonder if that will help shake that first half buzz out of them.
I think there was something that was very interesting that happened this weekend in the NFL too, and it was the Kansas City versus New England game, where they had Kansas City had that epically long drive at the end of the game when they needed two scores.
Yeah.
And that was because Andy Reid did not have faith in his defense to be able to do anything to be able to stop Tom Brady. Tom Brady had been hit one time that game. That's insane to think about a quarterback.
Well, behind a patchwork line.
Behind a patchwork line. Great
pass rush. Yeah, because how many times did Cam Newton got
hit on? Yeah, and New England has done phenomenal things with their offense and continue to be incredibly innovative.
Can we go back to that later?
Yes.
With New England's offensive line.
Yes. Okay. So, but what Kansas City did is they had absolutely no faith in their defense, where they had that long drive and then were basically banking on being able to get an onside kick, recovering the ball, and scoring again, and having those odds as opposed to scoring quickly, mm-hmm. kicking the ball off, having your defense play defense and do what they're supposed to do, getting the ball back and scoring again. Pete doesn't fear one unit of his offense or one unit of his team. Like, if that's Pete in that situation, they're going balls to the walls to score, and they're putting their defense right back down there, even if they've been torched all game long, because they believe that they're going to make a play, whether it's going to be an Earl Thomas slapping the ball out of the pylon or Cam Chancellor knocking the ball out of Calvin Johnson. They have that utmost belief that they will. Sometimes they do, as we've seen. Sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But is that absolute belief in somebody is going to find a way that they have. And it permeates throughout that whole team. Good, bad, it'll never be bad. Good or frustrating because they don't start off well. I totally get that, but it's not a concern that 14 points again.
Right. I just think that's fascinating. Like
in basketball, you guys play basketball. You're down 10 points in the second quarter.
That's
worried?
No, it's nothing. If it gets to 20, then you start to worry.
Yeah,
but
even at 15, you're like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you hit a couple threes, you get the momentum back, and all of a sudden it's a game again. I think, and if you're down 14 nothing or whatever, so like. My question is, like, do games like where they're down 14-0 to Washington or 9-0 against Minnesota, is that really,
but
like, the same? I mean,
sure. But at the same time, I mean, we're talking about games where in all of them, except for maybe the Patriots game, you said Seahawks are the most talented roster, mm-hmm. right? And yet, I mean, that's great if a deficit is, 14-point deficit isn't that big of a deal. That's great. It still really lowers your chances of winning the game, right? Mm-hmm. It's not insignificant that you're down 14-0. So. And so I guess for me, it's just I see it's not something that I'm comfortable with, that they're consistently down by this 9 points. And we saw this year, too. We saw this year in a lot of games that they just came out flat.
Yet they were consistently down or came out flat. Yet up until the St. Louis game, they still also led in every game. So
yeah, right.
Won,
exactly. Yeah,
they've won. Know, right. It's like
they've won three out of the four games that we're talking about, right?
Yeah. So we kind of just say,
I
think there's an element of every team's got its warts. That's theirs. Fuck it.
Pete Carroll talked about earlier in the year. I think they blew leads in like four or five games.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and he talked about how I think there's actually like concerted effort to like not peak too early in a game, because he said, well, based on the studies that we've done, like, you can see what happens when you score too quickly and whatever, or like, I don't know, like,
interesting.
He talked about how like you can see what happens if you peak too early in a game.
You know, that reminds me of something that we talked about last year, was that I think I referred to the Seahawks as the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, where they're always waiting to find the weaknesses, yeah. and once they did. Yeah. And then the first half, that's what they do.
Oh, so the
maybe
Raptors.
It's, yeah. The Raptors, that's it. So maybe they're not necessarily they're starting off slow, but they're just probing.
No, and I do subscribe to that a great deal, and I've talked about that a lot in the articles, and I think on the show, too, is that I think that's Pete Carroll sees not only the first half of games, but the first half of seasons as diagnosis, mm-hmm. and then the second half is treatment. And and I think that that is true. It just...
But that almost proves your point, because of the diagnosis the first half this year.
It would just be great if they didn't diagnose cancer every time,
yeah.
is
yeah,
what
exactly.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
You
and
know? Like, sometimes just diagnose a head cold and be down
3-0
and then turn it on. So... I do want to talk. I mean, we can hammer on this game or this season. Will there be plenty of time for that? I do want to look ahead to sort of the next phase, and that's free agency. The Seahawks have a number of free agents.
19 unrestricted.
You got it. And they've got some decisions to make. What I want to know from you guys is, who are the most important people to bring back?
One each. To who in your eyes is
of any of their unrestricteds?
Danny, you want to give us a rundown just while we're all thinking? You want to kind of just give us a rundown of who?
Well, I'll try and do it off the top of my head. There's Russell Okung, J.R. Sweezy, Jeremy Lane, Jermaine Kearse, John Ryan, Irvin Rubin on the defensive line, or same linebacker.
Did you say Shedd?
No, Deshaun Shedd is a restricted free agent, so you can pretty much assume the restricted free agents will be back.
Yeah.
Looking at, so who else is there? And there's Tuhuaku, DeMarcus Dobbs, guys like that aren't, you know, they're kind of secondary. Tavares Jackson. There's a whole bunch of guys that are kind of like
those are
backup.
I mean,
Mike Morgan.
You've hit everyone that might come up in our list. Yeah. So. For me, the player I like the most out of all of them is Bruce Irvin. Bruce Irvin's he's my guy. I think he's the dog that everyone wants in their kennel, you know? And I think that there might be a little bit of a market inefficiency with Bruce Irvin in that his talent should provide better free agency numbers, sacks, tackles, etc. But what they ask of him doesn't lead to a lot of box score production, which may depress his price. I think on true talent, he's probably a $7 or $8 million player, but in reality, he's probably closer to 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good.
You think seriously he could be gotten for 5 or 6?
Yeah. How many sacks did he have this year?
It's gonna.
He has
Atlanta and Jacksonville know him intimately. And so those would be the two that I would think would spend money. Those are the two.
But are either of them going to take him and then turn him into a pure pass rusher, or are they going to try and, you know, I think the big money is going to be some team that sees him as a, you know, Justin Houston type edge rusher. That
outside 3-4.
Which I think he could be, by the way. I think he definitely could. But I also wonder how much with a guy like Irvin, the idea of stability and a family atmosphere and a coach that believes in you and picked you out of the mire, so to speak, and took
money
a chance
can only
on you.
Buy you so much for your Jackson.
And I mean, get your right. Yeah, right. Immediately, like my instinct is Bruce Irvin, just because I just dig him. I dig his vibe. I think he's one of those personality kind of carry the mentality of his unit type of guys.
He embodies toughness, kind of.
Right, exactly. You want
him on your side, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Fight starts, you want him.
Exactly, right? Like we talked about last week, if you were to settle a game, you know, Greek hero style, and each army sends out a champion, Bruce is probably the guy you send out. Like, yeah. there's value to having that dude that when there's a skirmish on the field and he shows up, the skirmish is over, right? So that part of me makes it Irvin. But I think that we saw this year very dramatically how important having a second cornerback is. You know, and Seattle was, I won't call it luck because it's by design, but they were very fortunate. They were able to go Browner and then Maxwell and then Thurmond, right? That all of those guys, of course, left for big money elsewhere to varying degrees of success. And so they were left kind of grasping at straws. And they almost admitted as much when they signed Kerry Williams, right? The more than we wanted to pay for the position, but we had to do it.
I can't imagine they're going to do it again.
So I think that for me, the most important one is Jeremy Lin, because I think he's good. I think that he's, like, really good.
I think he's really good.
He's really good.
Yeah. So that was going to be my one on defense, Jeremy Lin. Because what he does is he can go down into the slot and cover those really quick guys.
That's
too
huge. Yeah.
Which is massive. That is a massive thing.
It's kind of like Tyrann Mathieu that way. You can play him inside, outside.
The cornerback position will be interesting next year because Thurl Simon's coming back. And everyone has always said he's the most talented physically. Can he get it together? And this is going to be a make or break year for him. He's had three years of varying degrees of success and mostly failure. This is the fourth year is going to be a huge year for him. Yeah. Offense, Jermaine Kearse, I think, is one of those very underrated players where we have Paul Richardson. Can Paul Richardson make it through a season? Because we got a play out of him.
Can he make it through a game?
Yeah, we got a play out of him this year. We didn't get a full season out of him last year, so you can't count on that.
Right.
And what Jermaine does is he allows Doug to stay in the slot. And that's a huge thing. Just allowing Doug to be in that slot position makes this a better offense. If we get Jimmy Graham back next year, but who knows to what degree he will be. That patella tendon injury is a horrible injury.
That's like worse than an ACL.
Far worse than an ACL.
And you hear Pete talking about fine. That's what he's like.
Yeah.
It's like he takes a, you know, man, he'll be back, Jimmy, he'll be great. And then you start reading
stuff
about
you do drugs?
You smoke drugs,
and then you read about it, there are people they're talking about 2 years out. You know, the mm-hmm. Pete's talking. Oh yeah, he'll be great for the beginning of next season. But it doesn't sound like there's any chance in hell.
Yeah, I don't think there's a chance in hell. Russell Okung with that salary.
You wonder if he's going to, because he had the separated shoulder. Mm-hmm.
What
right
is
there,
value
is it going to be?
He's representing himself. Because now the team agents are basically NFL specific lawyers, right?
Yeah.
They're highly trained in the art of the small print and what teams are trying to accomplish and all that stuff. So now teams are going to be negotiating against a football player, a very smart one,
but a football player,
mm-hmm. not someone who's
zero experience.
Who's never been in that.
Yeah,
room
but he
before.
Also still has lawyers that will be reading through the stuff for him. So it's not like he's truly representing himself. He just doesn't have an agent, which he's paying 3% to. He has an attorney that he's probably paying
but
an hourly or a set amount.
Will he get a contract, or will he end up doing a prove it contract? Because of the, and he's had it obviously every single year he's been injured.
My thought is just, and this is something that at BVM tweeted out yesterday or a couple days ago that I thought was really interesting. He's looking at Russell Okung's contract is 17 left tackles make $8 million or more. Mm-hmm. So say what you want about Russell Okung, he's at least league average.
Oh, yeah.
And so league average in free agency means you're getting paid league average and then some, right? That's just the cost of doing business. So I think that we're looking at 8 to 10 for Okung, shoulder injury or not.
That's a tough one. I still keep coming back to Jermaine on offense. I mean, Sweezy, I think, is a good guard.
Talk me into Jermaine Kearse.
I think what he does...
The Super Bowl cap. I mean, to put it down... Yeah. I'm sorry, man.
No. I think what he does is he gives that offense balance. He is not super quick. He's not unbelievable in any way, shape, or form. But what he does is he's just very consistent. And when shit breaks down, Jermaine gets open. Like, he is able to get open on the scramble drills, probably as good as anyone in the league, and probably better than anybody on this team. Tyler Lockett, we remember what he did in Minnesota, but there were times this year when you'd watch the All-22 when stuff broke down and Tyler would stand there. Jermaine is always looking to get open, and his cap number is going to be a more friendly cap number than a Russell Okung's or somebody like that. I still think Jeremy Lane, I agree with you. What he does for that defense is huge, but on the offensive side, I really do believe
it. So, okay, Kurtz. I buy that with Kurtz. And, I mean, I was a fairly harsh critic of Jermaine Kurtz at the beginning of the season. I called him the best of a bad wide receiver two situation.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I gave a mea culpa on him in this last week's article, and that I think he showed that he's a legit NFL playmaker. That being said, and I like the idea that he has more value to Seattle than he would to necessarily a different team, mm-hmm. right? Because of that balance.
Yep.
So, okay, congratulations, sold me on Jermaine Kurtz. Danny, what is the going rate for a Jermaine Kurtz?
See, that's a good question because...
Four?
I don't even really know. Because
what did Baldwin sign for 3 years? It was like 4 years and...
I don't know off the top of my head. It wasn't very much. It was like $4 or $5 million a year.
Which could factor in, though, too, was that, I mean, after that kind of season, are they going to go ahead and throw another mill or two to Baldwin?
Because Jermaine's totals, when you look at his numbers for the season, I don't know, I have them off the top of my head, but they don't jump out at you at all. He had some games where he was honestly one of the difference makers, and then he'd have a month where you didn't hear from him.
Yeah.
So his total production is a bit depressed, which again I think helps Seattle.
I don't think he's going to be very highly sought after.
No. Really?
No. I don't think, I mean, literally, like...
Can you keep Jermaine Kurtz? $4 million a year.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
I mean, I think it's a matter of, do you want to spend an extra $3 million on a receiver? Receivers are a dime a dozen.
Can they develop Kevin Smith or Kaysom Williams?
Maybe.
Maybe, but if that maybe
but on
they
the
start
open,
to feel like that they can and save the $4 million and put that at Jeremy, then...
I mean, it goes, and that's why it's so hard to answer these questions in terms of free agency because there's so
but
many
we
moving
want
parts
you
to it.
Answer them, Danny.
And be right. I don't think that Jermaine Kurtz is going to get big offers on the open market.
Really?
Like James Jones was a fucking street free agent until a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
you know, right, he was like a major part of the Packers' offense.
James Jones is actually probably a really great comp.
And it's amazing
skill size.
James Jones is actually, I think that works really well in terms of just like a comparison of this guy fits really, really well in the Packers offense. I don't really know what he would do in another offense.
Yeah.
You got to assume, too, for Jermaine, there's got to be an element of grew up in Tacoma, with the college at UW, the Hawks. I mean, is another million somewhere, hypothetically, in Jacksonville or wherever, is that worth it?
I think the way the Seahawks are trending, they're passing more. Russell Wilson threw it more than he ever has.
Yes.
He's way better than he's ever been. It behooves him to take a little less to stay here because he could actually earn a third contract.
More. That's a great point.
Absolutely. Over the life of a contract because I don't think he's going to get very much on the open market, honestly.
Well, and when you talk about going to free agency in other cities or other states, income tax is a huge thing
that
never gets brought up. But
really,
what an athlete pays in income tax,
I know, right?
What an athlete pays in income tax in New York or in California plays a huge deal into that. So a team in Seattle can get a player for less money on the cap, and that player comes out as a wash with them making more. And then, there's some players that just want to see every dollar in it and have as big of a number as they possibly can.
But Jermaine doesn't... I obviously don't know Jermaine or anything like that, but he hasn't ever presented himself to be a I-want-the-big-money kind of thing. Yeah. And you wonder with some of these guys, and even going so far as Bruce, that whether or not... They have been doing this. This is home.
Yeah.
If this being home will mean more, then it's almost the Michael Bennett. And, of course, Michael Bennett's now biting us in the ass. But you could have more money in Chicago, but, you know, he stayed here. How many guys are going to say, well, I know Pete.
Yeah.
I know this is a stable situation with Pete and John. We're going to be in the playoffs. We can make money.
Yeah. Free agency is dangerous.
It
honestly,
is.
It is. Like, going to a different team is really dangerous. I think the, I would, I don't know what this, like, I haven't done a study on it, but I think, especially for the receiver position, like, going to another team, starting out in a new offense, new coordinator, new quarterback.
Honestly, look, unless the Browns can pay you $6 million, great.
Unless you're Julio Jones or fucking whoever, like, wide receiver production is super scheme dependent, right? Like, you are an ancillary player. You're very important, but you are ancillary to the cause. And so I think that you're right. Wide receiver is a super dangerous position. If you have shown to your current team that you can be productive, I think that there's more value in a player's situation like Jermaine Kearse than you would see with a Michael Bennett or a Cam Chancellor, who's going to be successful wherever they go.
Well, and if you go to another team, what scheme are they running in? Are you in an advantageous position to succeed? Look at Byron Maxwell this year. We all know Byron Maxwell.
Look at Brandon Browner going from being a legit Pro Bowler in Seattle and New England.
Yes.
He goes to the Saints, scheme that doesn't fit him, and he is exposed as the worst corner in the NFL.
Yeah. And Byron Maxwell was the best rated cornerback in the free agent class this year.
You got it.
And we had him as a phenomenal. I mean, he was a number two only in the sense that we have Richard Sherman.
Right.
B Max was amazing.
He was really good.
Earl Thomas loved Byron Maxwell.
And look at how exposed he got because of what Philadelphia did schematically. He doesn't
Hopefully Lane has these wonderful examples in front of him.
This defense is going to put me in a position to look really good and not get exposed. And I know these guys, and it's the same system I've been in the whole time.
Okay.
I just think a veteran receiver making mid-level money, that's a dime a dozen. There's 100 of those guys.
So we could just bring somebody in the case that he...
I just don't think that he's going to get that much money. I just don't think that anyone's going to get into a bidding war for Jermaine Kearse.
Yeah. You know, I think that the two most interesting cases this year are going to be, and because you brought it up, Brent, Michael Bennett and Cam Chancellor. Because, yes, they are under contract, but lots of disgruntlement in last offseason. I'm not sure that they're any more gruntled this year than they were then. So I want to hear what you guys think in terms of what is it going to take? Because, okay, the leverage that the team had last year was they don't want to set precedent of extending guys that early in their contract. They lose that. Now they're 1 year away. This is now within the realm of experience for the front office to give some money to guys who are a year away. It's actually really smart. It's investing in the future for 80 cents on the dollar.
Both Cam and Bennett are 2 years short of the contracts.
Bennett, his contract is up after 2017.
Yeah.
So they have 62 years.
Cam 17 too.
Yeah. You're both through. Is it and then team option 17? Like they?
I've only ever seen that it was 2 years left.
Yeah.
After this,
because Bennett was 1 year into a 4 year deal.
Yep.
And Cam was 1 year in, but he had signed it previously. Okay. The extension. Yeah.
So, with that in mind, I imagine that those will be the two biggest contract storylines for the Seahawks this year. Those are two. Kelce McCray played really well. Frank Clark and Cassius Marsh played really well. That is leverage for the team that says, hey, if it comes to an untenable price, we've got some talent behind these guys. That said, to me, I think that Bennett and Chancellor are mentality guys. They're guys that carry a persona and that carry an energy and an intimidation factor. And if I'm a slot receiver and I'm running a crossing route into Cam zone, I'm thinking about it differently.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm an offensive tackle and I'm guarding Michael Bennett, I'm thinking about it differently, right? So not only is the box score production there, but I think the sort of mental advantage of being a true match of dominator is there for both of those players. And I think that Pete Carroll values that a lot. So my question to you guys is, what's it take to keep Bennett? What does it take to keep Chancellor? And should they do it?
Do you think if they guarantee Cam's money, will that be... I mean,
I don't think he's going to hold out again.
Yeah.
I think he lost a lot of money, and we don't know yet what happened with the Seahawks in terms of enforcing the fines, but we haven't heard... I don't think he has any leverage at this point. Yeah. I mean, he didn't have any leverage last year.
Yeah.
Now he really has no leverage because he...
You don't think they give him a raise, though?
No.
But Bennett... No.
I think Bennett. Bennett is probably, in my mind, the third best defensive lineman in the NFL behind Aaron Donald and J.J. Watt.
That
I think you give him. I think you give him a raise. I think you say you didn't hold out. You're one of our best players. Mm-hmm. You're literally unblockable at times.
Yeah.
I think they give him a raise and an extension, and it's their prerogative to do that. It's not like he's holding out or anything. Like they just decide to make that. Like an example of one of their core guys,
and that's what they obviously. That's what they've got.
Cam might be gone. Honestly,
I think so.
It's an interesting situation with him.
Yeah, they're going to need to. There is an element of them. They're going to need to save money in spots, and if they need to save money, and he ends up being problematic.
Did we ever find out why he wasn't in for the first series?
I never heard. It was a. In the kickoff, he got injured. I thought his.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't his tailbone.
So it wasn't a big deal.
No.
Bottom line is, his body is breaking down, it seems like, a little bit.
True.
You know, there's still probably some emotional. Like, he's probably not very happy with the team still at this point.
Well, if you look at it and you jettison, hypothetically, Cam, Marshawn, you have some of the more. Yeah, they always talk about wanting guys to be like they are, but at the same time, if you start jettisoning some of these guys,
protect the team.
Yeah, then you start to protect the team more.
Cam will be interesting in a decade when we actually find out what happened and how it all played out. That will be a fascinating thing.
I cannot wait for the 30 for 30 on the Carol Seahawks.
Because there will be, just follow up the Rise of Troy or whatever the one with USC was. No, because he lost two game checks, but how much of all of those fines were enforced? And what did they say to get him in? Or was it, we're not going to do anything, and he came in under his own accord?
Yeah.
And Seattle does a marvelous job of not letting that stuff ever get to the media, whereas some teams... It's a sieve of information, and it's bash the player at every turn. Seattle held strong, but they were always, we love Cam, we want Cam. And even when Cam was back, Pete was there in the presser with him, with his arm around him, talking about how much he loved him. And everybody always refers to him as the alpha to that defense. So it will be interesting to see. And he was the only holdout in all of the NFL last year, which is the other stunning thing. Yeah. He was the only guy holding out.
There's never been a real successful holdout.
No,
the CBA.
Those two things are going to be fascinating. I bet Bennett gets something reworked or tweaked. Cam, I can't imagine it happening.
So let me ask you guys this. This defense survives the loss of which of those guys better?
Cam.
Easily.
Cam.
Yeah.
I think Micah Bennett's one of their MVPs on defense.
And I feel like that's not meant as a slight towards Cam Chancellor.
No.
But more of a Michael Bennett is that good. I never considered him as a top three defensive lineman, but, you know, when you see that he had more QB pressures than J.J. Watt, when you see that he can play all of the positions. You can move him around to wherever. You can find your mismatch. Mm-hmm. His, you know, we always get upset about his offsides penalties, but his willingness to trust his instincts. For every time he gets caught in the neutral zone, there's two times where he just beats his dude off the snap, and that's why, you know, you never hear Carroll coming down on him about it. So I think that, for me, as much as I love Cam Chancellor, and Cam Chancellor might be one of my five or six favorite Seahawks of all time, to be completely honest with you, I think in terms of the future success of the team, Bennett is probably the number one guy that you got to keep happy.
He'll be 30, but...
But there's no slowdown. There's no slowdown. And great defensive linemen, we've seen great defensive linemen have success well into their 30s.
Yeah. And he is paired with other guys on the D-line that don't force him to be everything like J.J. Watt is forced to be everything.
And he doesn't have to play 60 snaps a game with Frank Clark and Cassius Marsh there and Cliff Averill.
While we're talking the D-line, though, and this is something I want to ask, Danny was, you know, with Mebane and Tuba, I mean, is there the hope, the possibility we can keep one of the two?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can keep one.
Keep one.
Who would you keep?
Tuba?
That's tough. I think I would probably keep Tuba.
A lot of decisions, obviously, for the Seahawks coming up. We're going to have plenty of time to process that. Unfortunately, we have an extra 3 weeks to process that.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you guys for tuning in all season. I think that, you know, I feel very, very blessed to have these guys on this show, and I hope that it has enhanced your football watching and Seahawks watching experience this year. The good news is you are going to see us a few times during the off season, so stay tuned for that. But for 2015 and early 2016, I'm your host, Jackson Bevins, for the Cigar Thoughts podcast. A huge, huge, huge thank you to Joel Litwin from RedCandle.net for making us look and sound as good as we do. Massive thank you to the Glow Nightclub in downtown Bellingham for being such hospitable hosts, keeping us stocked on potables and giving us a nice venue in which to operate. And I want to thank Brent Cole, Danny Kelly, Matt Nichols, and in absentia Isaac Williams for all your guys' help this year. And you guys will be seeing us soon. So again, thank you for tuning in. We'll catch you soon.